Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Rebecca, and I will be your host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Nobel Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Institute offers paid internships for students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Institute also offers classes, our nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door to our office or online at hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is Time to Rethink U.S. Policy on Iran. Today's guest is Barbara Slavin. Barbara is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's South Asia Center and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor, a new website devoted to news from and about the Middle East. Author of the 2007 book, Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation, she is a regular commentator on U.S. foreign policy and Iran on NPR, PBS, and C-SPAN. A career journalist, Barbara previously served as assistant managing editor for World and National Security of the Washington Times, senior diplomatic reporter for USA Today, Cairo correspondent for The Economist, and as editor of the New York Times Week in Review. She has covered such key foreign policy issues as the U.S.-led war on terrorism and, in Iraq, policy toward rogue states, the Iran-Iraq war, and the Arab-Israeli conflict. She has traveled to Iran 8 times and was the first U.S. newspaper reporter to interview Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Slavin also served as a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, where she wrote Bitter Friends, and as a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, where she researched and wrote the report Mullahs, Money, and Militias, How Iran Exerts Its Influence in the Middle East. I am pleased to present today's guest. Please join me in welcoming Barbara Slavin.
Thank you very much, and thank all of you for coming out on a Friday. I know that students like to sleep in usually on Friday mornings, so I'm particularly grateful. I'm very pleased to come to you at this time. This is a really interesting time to talk about the United States and Iran. As many of you may know, the U.S. and Iran have had a particularly dysfunctional relationship, if you can even call it a relationship, since 1979 when a pro-American dictator, the Shah of Iran, was overthrown, and Iran had an Islamic, what it called an Islamic revolution. Maybe some of you have seen the movie Argo. Have any of you seen that movie? I think that brings back very vividly the trauma that existed between the two countries at that time, and we've never really gotten over it. But we have some opportunities now, and I think it is time to rethink U.S. policy toward Iran because we have to approach this country in a new way. When I first went to Iran in 1996, it reminded me a lot of the old Soviet Union, where I went as a student in the 1970s. You had the same sort of atmosphere of young people, well-educated young people who were rather fed up with this old authoritarian government. You had a sense that change was possible, and people certainly were very eager to reach out to the United States and to reach out to the West. I have to say that we've seen some ups and downs. There was an Iranian president who did try to reach out. He had some opposition within his own country. We had some opportunities after 9/11 when Iran and the United States were actually on the same side. We were both against the government in Afghanistan, which harbored the terrorists that attacked us on 9/11, and the Iranians actually helped us overthrow that government. But some overtures from the Iranians were rebuffed by President George W. Bush, very unfortunately, I think. And as a result, we're now at a stage where the Iranians are really on the verge of becoming a nuclear weapons state if they make that decision. They have a nuclear program that has produced large quantities of low-enriched uranium, and they are in a position, if they decide, to turn that material into the fuel for nuclear weapons. We've had a lot of threats of war over the last year or so, some of them coming from Israel, some of them coming from people in the United States. President Obama has said that he will prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. So we've had a lot of tension in the area. And unfortunately, there have been some changes in terms of the Iranian people. I have been going to Iran, as I mentioned, since 1996, every couple of years, and I was recently there. I was there at the end of August and spent a week in Tehran. And what was very upsetting to me personally, I have to say, is that instead of the warm welcome I used to get as an American, you know, the people would distinguish themselves very much from the government attitude, this time people were not so welcoming. Some of that, I think, has to do with fear of being with foreigners. In 2009, Iran had presidential elections that were tainted by fraud, and millions of Iranians came out to protest those elections, and they were brutally crushed. The protest movement, it was called the Green Movement, was brutally crushed by the government. A lot of people were jailed. Some were executed. The leaders of that movement are still under house arrest, and it's been almost 2 years now. So I think there's a lot of fear about getting too close to foreigners. But beyond that, there's also anger, because under the leadership of the United States, economic sanctions have been put on Iran, sanctions that make it very difficult for Iran to sell its oil, very difficult for Iran to get paid for its oil. U.S. restrictions now forbid contact with any Iranian banks, and even with foreign banks that do dealings with Iranian banks. And these restrictions are having a really severe effect, not just on the Iranian government, but on ordinary Iranian people. Iranians are having great difficulty now getting medicine for life-threatening conditions like hemophilia and cancer. They're not getting medical supplies. Main reason is because companies, foreign companies that used to supply these medical devices and medicines, can't figure out how to get paid for what they send because of all the restrictions on the banks. The economy has suffered other severe effects. The currency that the Iranians use is now worth only 80% of what it used to be worth against the dollar. So this means that imported things are much more expensive for them, and their standard of living is going down drastically. And while people blame the government, they certainly don't like the government, they blame the United States too. So I think we need to have a new approach to dealing with Iran, one that focuses our sanctions on the nuclear issue, but tries to relieve some of the pressure on ordinary people. And I'm working now at the Atlantic Council of the United States, which is a think tank based in Washington. I'm working now on a new report that will be making some suggestions about how to go forward. When I look at Iran, I think of it in the context of other authoritarian countries that I have spent time in. I mentioned the Soviet Union. I was a Russian major in college, and I went to the Soviet Union when I was 21, and it was a life-altering experience to actually go and live there instead of just read about it. When I was a little bit older, when I was in my 30s, I went to China, just as China was beginning to open up to the outside world, and I was a correspondent there for a couple of years. So I think I know what works in terms of opening up these places and building bridges to the populations of these countries. Now, with Iran, it's obviously not going to be easy. The Iranians, to a large extent, had their revolution to get rid of U.S. influence. They hated the Shah, who was backed by the United States, and the leader of the revolution felt that Iran had to be completely independent from the superpowers of the world. And one of the reasons that Iran seized those American hostages and held them for 444 days was to make sure that the ties with the United States were broken, and really broken irrevocably. He succeeded beyond his wildest dreams. It's 34 years later, and we still have no diplomatic relations with Iran. But as the country is no longer the ideological country that it was back in 1979, and if we can think of a way to build bridges, one example is through academic exchanges. Universities should try to have twin universities, perhaps, in Iran. There are a lot of areas that we could cooperate with the Iranians on where there's mutual interest. For example, Tehran, the capital of Iran, sits on a major fault zone and has massive earthquakes from time to time. Iran is very prone to earthquakes. Things like seismic research, global warming, water pollution, agriculture, a lot of things, AIDS research, other kinds of medical research, where we could work together with the Iranians and on apolitical projects that would be of benefit to both societies. I'm sure some of you know Iranian students. There used to be a lot of Iranian students who came to the United States. We should try to encourage that, subsidize that if possible, and try to send American students also to Iran. You can do these things despite the political difficulties. We should change the sanctions regime. We should retool it so that medical supplies can go there easily. Now, the U.S. government recently said that you don't have to apply for a special license from the Treasury Department to sell certain basic medicines to the Iranians. But because of the banking restrictions, people still are not providing these urgently needed supplies. So perhaps we should set up a dedicated banking channel, designate a bank or two in Iran that is a private bank, has nothing to do with the government, where you could actually process these transactions, where American and European companies could sell medicine and could be assured that they could get paid. It can be done if we are creative about it and we really care. What else do we need to do? We need to re-energize diplomacy with Iran. And here I think we have some good news. The re-election of President Obama means that we will have more negotiations with Iran. If Mitt Romney had won, he would have put in a new team of diplomats. He would have probably subjected Iran policy to a lengthy review, and there would have been no assurance that he would have continued the diplomatic track with the Iranians. We've had a bunch of meetings with the Iranians over the last year, usually in a multilateral setting. It's something called the P5 plus 1. This is the five permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany meeting with the Iranians. President Obama has said that he is ready to meet one-on-one with the Iranians, which I think would be a much more productive way to go forward. It's kind of hard to reach an agreement when you have seven parties in a room, each with their own individual interests. So I'm hopeful we're going to get some new talks with Iran. They're not going to be easy. The Iranians, somebody once said negotiating with Iran is like eating soup with a fork. They're tough, and they have a lot of built-up grievances from the days of the Shah, from the sanctions, from the fact that the United States supported Iraq against Iran during a war, the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s, which killed a quarter of a million young Iranians. They have a lot of resentment built up. But I think the economic sanctions are really biting now, and the Iranian leadership understands that if they're going to be able to prosper as a nation, they have to find a way to relieve some of the pressure on the country. There's another factor that's involved in that and in this whole issue, and that's Israel. For Israel, Iran is an existential threat. At least that's the way the Israeli leadership has described Iran. Israel does not want to lose its nuclear monopoly in the Middle East. Israel is the only country in the Middle East right now that has nuclear weapons. And, of course, it considers that an ultimate deterrent. The Iranian leadership, particularly the current president of Iran, has said some quite awful things about Israel and has talked about Israel being wiped from the pages of history. So the Israelis are quite rational to fear Iran. Iran also supports a number of Arab groups that are opposed to the state of Israel. But the Israelis should not be able to dictate U.S. policy toward Iran. And a war in the region would be devastating for everyone. It would involve enormous retaliation against Israel. We've already seen what just a little group called Hamas can do from Gaza. You can imagine if Israel attacks Iran, then I would think that Hezbollah, which is a group based in Lebanon to the north of Israel, would also attack Israel. Many Israelis would die. Of course, many Iranians would die. The Hinckley Institute was involved in putting out an excellent paper not very long ago, which talked about the civilian casualties that would happen in Iran from military strikes on its nuclear installations, which are widely dispersed around the country. Some of them are, of course, based in major cities. And hundreds, if not thousands, of Iranians would die from strikes on these facilities, if not immediately, then from radioactive and other materials that would be released from strikes on these sites. So that would be a terrible blot. And, of course, the United States cannot afford another major war in that part of the world. President Obama is sitting down today with Republican leaders of Congress trying to work out some sort of deal that will reduce our budget deficit, enable us not to have to raise taxes. And, you know, we financed two wars on a credit card over the last decade, and those credit cards are now completely tapped out. So we don't need another war in that part of the world. That's not what we need. It's a region in turmoil. We can talk about a little bit in the Q&A. You have new governments coming to power in Arab countries that are much more responsive to the wishes of their people. And if the United States or Israel were to attack Iran, the entire Arab world, the entire Muslim world would certainly oppose that and see that as something that was unprovoked, because Iran, as we speak now, does not have nuclear weapons, and yet they are being punished with these draconian sanctions. So I think it's, as I say, time to rethink our policy toward Iran, to go back to the drawing board. I'm hopeful that Obama can be more flexible now that he's won his reelection, and I'm hoping also that the Iranians will be a little bit more flexible now that they're being subjected to these kinds of draconian sanctions. I think I'm going to leave it there and open it up to all your questions. And please feel free to ask not just about Iran, but also about other issues. Thank you very much. Yes.
Oh. And just real quickly, if you do have a question, please speak directly in the microphone and state a little bit about yourself.
Hi, my name is Amber Anderton. I'm a political science and strategic communications major. Earlier this week, we had a panel discussion in respect to Iran, and they mentioned that to enrich uranium for the purposes of providing power, that they would only need to enrich it 3.5%, and currently they've enriched to the tune of 20%. Mm-hmm. That seems to be an indication that they're if not, or if they don't already have nuclear weapons, that they're well on their way. Mm-hmm. Why should we lift sanctions in order to help their economy if that be the case?
Mm-hmm. That's a very good question. I'm not talking about lifting sanctions. I'm talking about retooling them. The sanctions that apply to Iran's nuclear program, that apply to individuals within the Iranian government who are connected to the nuclear program, by all means, keep those sanctions. But the sanctions that prevent Iranians from getting cancer drugs or hemophilia drugs make no sense. They don't affect the government so much as they affect ordinary people. And they, if you could turn that off, please, thank you. And they turn ordinary Iranians against the United States. The great strength that we had as a nation in Iran was that ordinary people actually liked us. And as I mentioned during my last visit there in August, I found that people were not as friendly as they used to be. So, you know, if we keep Iran from developing nuclear weapons, that's great. But if we lose the goodwill of the Iranian people for another generation, then we will not have served U.S. national interest. Yeah. Wait for the... Oh, sorry.
Hello, my name's Adam Curtis. I've just got a question. Both Barack Obama and Governor Romney both expressed that they would go to war if Israel was attacked, or, you know, that they would protect Israel. No,
that's not what they said exactly. No, they said they would prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons.
Do you think that Obama really would, now that he's president, really will fulfill that threat, or do you think he'll just pursue different kinds of dealing with that?
Yeah, well, you know, Iran has not yet developed nuclear weapons, as I mentioned. They've not yet made that decision. I personally think that the only thing that would actually drive them to develop nuclear weapons is if we do attack them, or Israel attacks them, which would give them a perfect excuse to develop nuclear weapons. For Obama, I think he's made it very clear that diplomacy is his first and best option. He said that just recently in his press conference earlier this week, that he intends to really move hard on the diplomatic front. You always, as an American president, have to keep the military option on the table, I suppose. But, I mean, we have a credible military option, and Iran knows that perfectly well. So that's another reason why I think they won't go all the way in that direction. I personally don't think there is a military solution to the Iranian nuclear program, no matter what President Obama says or what Mitt Romney said during the campaign, because we can't destroy the program in its entirety. We can't destroy the knowledge in the heads of Iranian scientists, and they would rebuild the program. So all it would do is set the program back by a year or two. It would kill a lot of innocent people in Iran and elsewhere, as there was retaliation. And we would not have eliminated this menace of nuclear weapons in Iran.
Hi, my name is Mulakwe. My question is, if the U.S. Help out Iran, is that they going to like defend with the U.S. and stop killing the civilization?
Stops killing. I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Civilization.
Well, I don't think the U.S. and Iran are going to be friends, bosom friends, anytime soon. But my hope is that they'll stop being, bitter friends and move to something that's a little bit more neutral, kind of like the situation we had with the Soviet Union and with China when we had détente, what we call détente. We still opposed each other in terms of policies in many places in the world. We criticized each other. But we had a relationship. We had embassies. We had diplomats going back and forth. We had students going back and forth, business people, tourists. And we began to build bridges to the societies. You know, this is what we need to do, and that's why we have to change the sanctions policies so that we can support this kind of contact between the two peoples. The young people of Iran are the future of Iran. This leadership that's currently there will not be there forever. So we have to think toward that day.
Hello, I'm Zach Zabawa. I'm an international studies major here. But I really appreciate your work, by the way.
Thank you.
It's just definitely pursuing a different option other than the military. So it's very valuable. But what we've discussed recently, like when we had a forum last week, was they really only said sanctions or military option. Like, they didn't give any, like,
It was really no third
sad,
way.
Like, to really hear that, like, the generals and whatnot speak to that. But the problem is, like, any actions that we do take, it's being the Iranian public are being misinformed. How can we overcome that? And that's one of the points that they made last week. I don't know if you have any fresh ideas.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly is a problem. A lot of the Iranian population, what they see in their press is that they have a peaceful nuclear program and the world is against them, and all they want is peaceful nuclear energy, and it's unfair that they should be punished because Israel has nuclear weapons and nobody punishes them, Pakistan, India, so forth. That is difficult, but a large segment of the Iranian population does have access to particularly foreign television. The BBC has an excellent service in the Farsi language that reaches a lot of Iranian homes. And many Iranians are really internet savvy. It's a very wired, particularly the young people, very, very wired. And it is possible to put information out there that exposes them to the reality of what their government is doing, to the dangers of nuclear weapons, to the dangers of a military strike and what that would involve. I mentioned that the Hinckley Institute was involved in putting out a paper about the civilian casualties that would occur if there was a strike, and I understand that this paper has been translated into Farsi and put up on the web so that Iranians can get access to it. And the other thing is that if the U.S., through its actions, demonstrates that it's not against the Iranian people. For example, makes it easier for Iranians to get medicine and medical supplies and so on. Then Iranians will understand that this is not about them, it's about their government. So we have to work on a number of different fronts. It's not just sanctions or military action. There are other things that we can do.
My name's Ashley Jolin, and I'm an English and political science major. I love your concept of, you know, giving medicine to the Iranians and doing these other ways of building mm-hmm. relationships. What do you think are the major roadblocks to, I mean, because the media portrays Iran not in the best light. And so I was curious what you thought, what roadblocks do we have and how can we overcome them?
Well, the U.S. Congress is a big roadblock. And there you can really help because the U.S. Congress has never met an Iran sanction that it doesn't like. There's a lot of pressure from interest groups on individual members of Congress in particular and senators. There was a sanctions, the sanction against the Iranian Central Bank passed the U.S. Senate 100-0. 100-0. So, I mean, you need to get involved in politics. You need to write to your congressmen, your senators, and say, think about the consequences of what you're doing. Is this really serving long-term U.S. interest? Or is it just something you do so you can get money from people and get reelected? Again, you have to think of the long-term goals here. During the Cold War, which you all of you are too young to remember, but during the Cold War, the U.S. government was very active in terms of exchanges, media, all sorts of ways trying to influence the Russians, the East Europeans, so that they would understand that they had, you know, friends in the United States that wished them well. And we can be doing a lot more on that front. But the best way is through personal contact. When you go to Iran or when Iranians come here and you actually meet each other and they, you know, you understand how much you have in common and so on, that's the most powerful way of building bridges. It's really one at a time. So, you know, you actually can go to Iran as a tourist. I highly recommend it. It's a beautiful country. It's not terribly expensive these days, what with the collapse of the currency. And tourists are, you know, quite safe as long as you don't try to sneak into the country or, you know, something like that, like some folks occasionally try to do. As long as it's open and above board, it's actually quite safe, and you'll have a good time. Food's really good, too, I must say. So, you know, approach it in that direction. I think it's possible to make some progress.
Thank you. Thank you for the excellent presentations. My name is Alid, and I'm a political science major here. My question is, I would say that it's really hard with the economic struggle to imagine that U.S. will go to war with Iran, you know. But my question is, what about Israel? Mm-hmm. Do you think that Israel will be able to withhold, I mean, to follow United States foreign policy to not go into war with Iran? Because we know this, I heard and I read the news that we know the situation and the condition within Tehran and Tel Aviv is really, really dysfunctional, like you said just now. So do you think that United States, in this case, Obama administration, will be able to withhold Israel's, you know, desire to go to war with Iran? Thank you.
Yeah, I think absolutely we can. I think we have. The fact is that Israel cannot do that much damage to the Iranian program. It can hit a few selected sites, but it cannot do the sort of damage that makes it worth going and actually, you know, conducting this sort of strike. The Israeli game plan all along has been to get the U.S. to do it for them. And with Obama reelected, I think the chances of that are much smaller, frankly, than they would have been before. Also, if you read about the argument, the debate in Israel, they've had a very public debate over Iran, and the vast majority of the military and intelligence establishment within Israel is opposed to striking Iran. For many of the main reasons that I suggested, there'd be awful retaliation, of course, against Israel. But it wouldn't do that much, and, you know, it would give Iran the excuse to make nuclear weapons. The other factor is this incredible turmoil in the region that we're watching. Right now, the Israelis are engaged in a war with Gaza, again. And the Israelis are petrified that the new government in Egypt is going to walk away from the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. New government in Egypt is led by a Muslim brother. It's under a lot of pressure because of what's happening in Gaza. So I think the Israelis, frankly, have much bigger concerns right now than whatever Iran is doing. Iran is far away. And whatever Benjamin Netanyahu says, Iran is not going to attack Israel with nuclear weapons, even if it were to get a bomb. It would be suicidal on the part of any Iranian government. I think Netanyahu uses this argument in order to get more sanctions on Iran, in order to get more sympathy for Israel in order to try to pressure U.S. government, European governments, and so on. And he's been very effective at that. But he's got other worries. Syria is in the middle of a civil war. Jordan is very fragile now. Israel has to worry about its immediate neighborhood. So I think that also gives us a little bit of breathing space for diplomacy with the Iranians.
Hi, my name is Kyle Perkins, and I was wondering what the U.S. has done or what they can do to promote positive relationships among the countries in the Middle East. If they do anything to help those countries themselves without the U.S. involved.
Positive relationships in the sense of U.S. relationships with those countries or just among them all?
Just them, mm-hmm. themselves.
Well, that's a really tall order, because what we've seen, particularly in the last couple of years, is that there are deeper and deeper divisions within the Middle East, political divisions, also religious divisions. Most of the Middle East, most of the Arab countries, now remember, Iran is Persian. That's different. It's a different ethnicity. It's a different language. And there's a historic divide between Persians and Arabs. But most of the region is Sunni Muslim. This is the majority sect in Islam. And Iran is a Shia Muslim nation. It's a very different interpretation of the faith. And Shia and Sunni do not get along. As a consequence, in particular, of what's been happening in Syria, the Sunni countries are all supporting the rebels against the government of Bashar Assad, who is not a religious person, but he belongs to a sect that's closer to the Shia. And also, his government has been an ally of Iran for the past 35 years. So Iran supports the government of Syria. The Arab world, majority of it, Turkey, all the Sunni Muslim countries are supporting the opposition. And the divide is getting worse and worse. The United States is also trying to get rid of the government in Syria. So we're siding with the Sunnis, basically. And we're part of this sectarian conflict now, which means we're not in a very good position to try to heal the wounds. That's going to be very difficult. I mean, it's been since the 700s that these two sects have been opposed to each other. So it's not a divide that will easily be resolved. But I think we're going to have to live through what happens in Syria, wait for the government there to change. And, you know, maybe then there's a possibility if they can come up with a government that represents the majority of Syrians and is not just beholden to one religious group or another. But they're in the midst of a religious war, a political war, a generational war. It's a very, very tumultuous time in that part of the world.
Hello again.
Yeah.
You mentioned given the sanctions and the restrictions that the U.S. cannot provide critical medicine and things of that nature to Iran, have any NGOs stepped in to do so? Mm-hmm. And
it's a good question.
Let's see. Yeah, and also why aren't more Iranians? I've actually met an Iranian that came from Tehran to mm-hmm. the United States. Why aren't more people becoming refugees if they're so displeased with their form of government?
Okay. Well, first of all, the NGOs have to abide by U.S. law, just like everybody else. And as I mentioned, theoretically you can send medicine and medical supplies to Iran. But in reality, you can't because of the banking restrictions. That gets in the way. You can't figure out how to get paid for it. Now, if you're an NGO, you just want to donate it. That's a little bit easier. And Iran had an earthquake recently in part of the country, and some NGOs were able to get a license from the Treasury Department to donate. But in practical terms, donations are not going to, you know, meet the needs of a population of over 70 million people. That's not going to be enough. So it helps, but, you know, it's not sufficient. And your other question, sorry, was about why aren't more people leaving? People are leaving. Iran has a huge brain drain, and it accelerates all the time. Particularly educated people are always trying to come out. I'm sure you probably know Iranian doctors and engineers, and, you know, we have almost 1 million Iranian Americans now, and there are others in Europe and in Canada and Australia. So, I mean, there's a huge Iranian diaspora. Many people left after the elections in 2009. Political refugees came out. A lot of journalists had to leave, and I know a bunch who wound up in Turkey, and some of them finally managed to get to the United States. When I was there in August, people, for the first time, blue-collar workers were talking about trying to get out because the factories are, a lot of them are laying people off because they can't get the materials they need from Europe, say, to build cars and trucks because of the sanctions. A lot of European companies are no longer providing that kind of material. For blue-collar workers, it's a little more difficult. But yeah, I mean, a lot of Iranians are trying to leave. And it's good for them if they get out, but it's bad for Iran because it's being deprived of its best and its brightest, its young people, and it's going to destroy the society. So the solution is not to make all of Iran refugees. The solution is to try to resolve some of our problems with Iran and you know, put the country, put the leadership in a sense that we're not out to get them and that there's something in it for them to improve the ties. And that will mean a general lessening of tensions, and everybody will be able to breathe a little bit easier, including the people of Iran.
Do we have any more questions?
Hi, yeah, I'm Russell Lee. I'm a senior in political science, and thank you for your refreshing viewpoint. It's nice to have that kind of perspective. One question I had was, is there anti-government sentiment enough in Iran right now to maybe have another green revolution, maybe overthrow the government?
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of anti-government sentiment, but after what happened following the 2009 elections, you know, people were very, very demoralized by that. It was a really brutal crackdown, and Iran already had a revolution, you know, 34 years ago, and it didn't turn out very well. And particularly older people remember how many people were killed, all the dislocation, and that the result was not something that they really liked. So it's hard to anticipate that people would come out en masse again and rise up in that way. The monopoly of force is still with the government. They have a very powerful security services, powerful military. They have a kind of paramilitary group they call the Basij, 10 million strong. So I don't really see it. I see discontent. I see occasional protest strikes, certainly from time to time, and a lot of complaining on the part of people. But I don't think that's the way change is going to come there. I think it's going to be a gradual process. And I don't know, many of you know who Mikhail Gorbachev was. He was the leader of the Soviet Union who essentially opened the place up and changed course. And Iran has ayatollahs. It's led by an ayatollah. This is a cleric. And I'm waiting for an Ayatollah Gorbachev to come along, somebody who comes with a clerical background but who understands that Iran has to change for its own sake and for the sake particularly of its younger generation coming up and will be willing to, you know, reach out a hand to the U.S. And so we have to be ready to seize that opportunity if it comes, and it will come at some point, I think.
Hi, thank you for your comments on that. My name is Pamela Porto Carrero, and I am a political science major. My question was, you mentioned that better diplomacy with Iran will help improve the relationships with us, but at the same time, what does the U.S. need to see in order for those sanctions to ever be lifted? Mm-hmm. What is the goal or the purpose of those sanctions, and what does the Iranian government need to do in order for that to completely be removed?
Yeah, well, there's short-term goals and long-term goals. The short-term goal is to stop Iran from enriching uranium to 20% U-235. As was mentioned, Iran needs uranium enriched up to 5% of this isotope for the purpose of using it in a nuclear reactor to make energy, for example. But Iran has been enriching to 20%. Now, it says that it needs this fuel for a reactor that makes medical isotopes. But the international community has offered to provide this fuel to take Iran's stockpile of 20% and turn it into the proper kind of fuel for this reactor if Iran will stop making the 20% on its own. So this is the first thing that has to happen. Now, the U.S. put a proposal down on the table over the summer, but it offered no sanctions relief whatsoever. It promised Iran spare parts for their civilian airliners, you know, some limited cooperation on peaceful nuclear energy, that sort of thing. But it didn't promise any sanctions relief. So I think, and this is what I've been given to understand from my contacts with the Obama administration, that they're ready to put something down on the table that would offer some relief of the current sanctions, that would make it less onerous for Iran if they're willing to put an end to this 20% enrichment and put a verifiable cap that they will not go beyond 5% enrichment of the uranium. So that's the first step. But the other things we can talk to them about, the U.S. wants to get out of Afghanistan. Iran can help or it can hurt. Iran has a lot of influence in Afghanistan, particularly the western part. And they can make it easier for the United States to withdraw, and they can make it easier for Afghanistan to become a stable nation. They can help us help Iraq become more stable. They have a lot of power in that part of the world still. So we should talk to them not just about the nuclear issue, but about regional issues. And we should also talk to them about human rights, about the way they treat their own people. Iranians are affected by this criticism. They care when the rest of the world accuses them of being brutal. Recently, a blogger died in detention in Iran, and there was a big stink in the international media, but there was also a big stink in Iran. Members of parliament called for an investigation. They arrested a couple of the security people who had been detaining this young man, and even some Iranian newspapers wrote about it. So if we raise human rights with them, it can have an impact. We should talk about all the issues that we care about.
I'm Tim Chambliss. I teach here at the university. Thank you very much for speaking to us. I have a two-part question. One, if there is to be a peaceful solution, can that peaceful solution come from within Iran with its population of more than 70% who were born after January, February of 79? Or could that also come from maybe Iranian Americans, many of whom, thousands, have moved here to Utah because mm-hmm. of the topography, the demographics are very similar.
Your beautiful mountains. Yeah.
Very, very similar to Iran, Utah and Iran. I've had three students from Iran live in my home over the years. Mm-hmm. And my impression is that they have a great longing for their home country. And if there was something they could do from Utah, mm-hmm. to facilitate a peaceful resolution, a détente of some kind, a rapprochement of some kind, they would want to do that. And in double-checking, the Bashish, to what extent are they basically like the Savak?
The Basij. No, they have their own Savak.
Their own Savak.
Their own security services. The Basij are a popular movement that's paid by the government to crack heads during demonstrations mm-hmm. and to keep order. But on your question about what Iranian Americans can do, Iranian Americans already do a lot. They do a lot in terms of supporting NGOs, trying to help individual Iranians. I know a number who are involved in NGOs that take very, very sick Iranian children and provide them with medical care, that kind of thing. But beyond that, I think the main thing they can do is try to remain bridges between the two societies. So, you know, to send information to Iran about what's really going on, what the government is doing there. After the 2009 disturbances, a lot of Iranian Americans on Facebook would post information and videos and so on, you know, and amplify the videos and the information they were getting from the young dissidents within Iran. So information, this sort of thing. In terms of overthrowing the Iranian government, no. That's up to the Iranian people. So what we have to do is just put the message out there that we care about this country, we care about these people, we don't want the people to suffer, we want to help them in whatever way we can, and that we expect that Iran, which has, frankly, a longer history than any other country in that region of trying to have a democracy, they had their first constitutional revolution in 1906, you know, before any of these other countries did, that we believe that they will get there on their own and that we will support them.
Hello. Thank you for being here. My name is Stephen Goodwill, and I am a freshman here at the University of Utah. And I just have a question as to what should the U.S. do if these sanctions do not work and Iran continues to enrich uranium. Because the whole point of these sanctions is to stop them from getting a nuclear bomb. What if they continue to push forward? What is the U.S. supposed to do?
That's a very good question. I'm glad you raised it. I think we should continue with the policy that we've had for 34 years, which is containment. This is a concept for you political science majors. You've all read about George Kennan and the idea of containment, containing the Soviet Union until the internal contradictions within that society change the government. It's exactly the policy we need to have with Iran. Containment means being strong militarily, having a military presence in the region so that our, you know, nervous allies are all reassured that the United States is there. It means certain sanctions on the Iranian nuclear program and missile program and so on. It means arms talks. It means talking to them, diplomacy, lots of it, exchanges, all the things that I mentioned under the rubric of containment. If Iran continues the program, that's unfortunate. If Iran actually does get a nuclear weapon, that's very unfortunate. But the sky's not going to fall, and we can continue. I mean, if Iran actually builds and tests a nuclear weapon, then I think even the Russians and Chinese would stop buying oil from Iran. Certainly they would support much tougher sanctions against Iran. Iran's support in the non-aligned, the developing countries, would evaporate because the Iranians, you know, their supreme leader says that it's against Islam to have nuclear weapons. So if he's caught out as a liar, as having deceived the world all along, that's not going to help his image. I don't think Iran is actually going to go all the way unless we attack them. So containment, it worked really well with the Soviet Union, worked really well with China. It'll work perfectly well with Iran, and eventually we will see change.
I have a question for you.
Please.
Obviously, you've touched on this a little bit, and we're all very much aware of the extensive road that we have to travel in order to regain this diplomacy. And my question for you is, what is the first step which will be most beneficial and serve as the gateway for continued diplomatic relations and strengthening the relationship between the U.S. and Iran?
Well, the first step is to meet one-on-one in a confidential manner, away from the news cameras and so on. There have been a lot of stories in the press that some of these contacts have already taken place, and I know messages are passed back and forth between Iranian officials and American officials all the time, if not directly, then through intermediaries, what we call track 2 diplomacy and track 1.5 diplomacy, where you have former U.S. officials or people who are close to the president who meet with certain Iranians, you know, in New York when the Iranians come to the UN every year, or in Europe, various places, Turkey. So I think that these kind of contacts have to be raised to a higher level, and we have to begin to talk about all the differences that we have. I mean, it's easier to resolve our differences with Iran than it is for Israel to resolve its differences with the Palestinians. We're not talking about exchanging territory and evicting people, you know, who live in certain areas, or accepting refugees back, or all these other sorts of things. These are disputes over nuclear infrastructure, over diplomatic actions, over orientation towards Syria, Lebanon, whatever. These are things you can talk about.
And I guess just a follow-up then, what do you feel the first action would be?
Well, both sides have to agree to this kind of contact. Now, Obama's already said that he's ready. So the question is Iran ready? And, you know, the Iranians, sometimes they say they're ready, but they aren't. It's been... if you read my book, Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, I write that, you know, we're always out of sync, that whenever we're ready, they're not. Whenever they're ready, we're not. It's partly because they're a smaller power. It's not like the Soviet Union or China that can sit, you know, mano to mano with us. It's unequal. It's an unequal relationship. So Iranians are always looking for leverage, for extra cards to play. I think that's one of the reasons why they enriched to 20%, because it's a great card to play with the U.S., but they want to get something back, right? So they have to be convinced that now is the time, that we do have a window. Our elections are over. Their elections don't come until June. That now is the time to actually sit and talk about some of this. And I've seen some hopeful signaling from Iran, but you know, I've seen signaling like this before, and it hasn't amounted anything. So I'm, as we say, cautiously optimistic that something will happen this time.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Do we have any other questions?
Hi, my name is Brad Call. I'm an international studies major here at the U. My question for you is, for most of my life, and especially the most recent years, public opinion has been so geared against Iran, and we're steered to think that Iran is trying to destroy the Middle East with their nuclear weapons or whatever. Mm-hmm. But what needs to be done to put the public opinion in favor of working more with Iran instead of against Iran?
Well, everybody should read my book. no, seriously. Actually, most of the opinion polls show that Americans don't want to go to war with Iran. Americans are sick of war in the Middle East. And, you know, during the campaign, there were some efforts by some individuals and groups and countries to kind of play on this issue. Didn't get very far. In the last debate, the foreign policy debate, I was stunned to hear Mitt Romney talk about peace, peace, peace. You know, I come in peace, he kept saying. Like he was, you know, some alien who had landed on Earth, you know, I come in peace. So, you know, even I don't think he would have started a war, frankly, with Iran if he had been elected president. So people are looking for solutions. It's just that we haven't had too many creative ideas. And that's why, as I mentioned, I'm hoping that, you know, in my work at the Atlantic Council and so on, that we can come up with some creative ideas that are positive for a change. And not just about how can we cripple this country and, you know, and push its nose into the ground. That's not how you resolve disputes. Yes, you put pressure, you get leverage, but you also offer a way out. You offer an escape hatch. Because if you don't, you will get a war, and that's not what anybody wants.
We have time for one more question.
You've got a lot of questions.
Sorry to dominate.
That's okay.
It seems as if you're putting a lot of the responsibility and obligation on the U.S. With Iran not really reciprocating.
No, not at all. Not at all. I said Iran has to stop enriching uranium to 20%. That's a big concession when you consider the price that Iran has paid to get to where it is in this nuclear program. That's a very big concession.
Well, they won't even let us in to inspect their facilities.
That's not true. The International Atomic Energy Agency inspects their facilities twice a month. You need to read up on this.
Okay, well, I apologize for my ignorance, but that, I thought, was one of the main reasons. What are some things that Iran can do to open up more dialogue for these creative, positive,
right. Well, they,
resolutions?
They can agree to meet one-on-one, as I mentioned. But they can also agree to allow even more access to the International Atomic Energy Agency than they do now. But they already have regular access to all of their declared nuclear facilities, you know, which is something that we didn't have when we went to war with Iraq, because Iraq had thrown out the inspectors, as you may recall, in 1998 after the U.S. bombed Iraq. The danger of a war is that Iran would also throw out all the inspectors, and then we wouldn't have a clue as to what is going on. Now we actually have a fairly good idea of how much enriched uranium they have and enriched to whatever levels. But sure, Iran can open up more. It can be much more proactive. It can offer real concessions to the U.S. It takes two, absolutely. But why do I mean, I'm an American. I can't tell the Iranian government what to do. But I can offer constructive criticism of my own government. And we're the big guy here. We're the superior power. We're the ones who can destroy that country. So I think it's incumbent on us, you know, to reach out the hand and to understand that Iran is in a situation where people there feel vulnerable, if not paranoid, about the outside world.
Well, that is all we have time for today. Please join me in welcoming Barbara Slavin for an excellent and informative forum.